Welcome, friends,
to a special cut-down discount version of the Linux Voice podcast. We don't have a mic today. Well, actually, we've got a mic each. yes, this is the Linux Voice podcast, episode 16, series 4. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
And we have no Mike Saunders because he's busy just doing really awesome stuff. But fear not, because we have other, even more awesome stuff to share with you this fortnight, including news, including fines, including, oh, no neurons. Ah, well, we can make one up. And we've got a voice of the masses, which is bursting with positivity. If you like the sound of that and you would like to subscribe, hang on, no, that's not right. If you like the sound of that and you'd like to read more of this sort of Linux-based positivity, then you can find us in Linux Magazine, which we'll come to later, very shortly, in fact.
Shall we come to it now?
Let's come to it now.
Right. So, yeah, the first item of news this fortnight that many of you will be aware of is that Linux Voice has merged with Linux Magazine. So we are no longer an independent standalone magazine called Linux Voice. We're now a section of Linux Magazine. So we're continuing to write pages, talk about Linux, all that sort of thing. But it will be in a new format. Well, actually in the same paper format, but in a new magazine. You'll be able to keep reading our words, but there's a different name on the front of the magazine now.
My first copy now. It's like a deja vu almost. Like it's different, but it's the same. It's the same words. It's the same colours. It's the same font. It's quite comforting in a way that we're living on.
I haven't seen the physical copy yet. Only the electrons.
Yeah, it's a big change. I suppose it's a bit of a shock to everyone, but I guess it wasn't so much of a shock to us. I mean. I think it's fair to say we had to do something, otherwise we would have just gone bust. And I'm really glad that Linux Voice is carrying on in some way. And the podcast carries on too, so.
Yeah, the podcast's not going anywhere, apart from Mike. Although he will be back soon.
Obviously, it's difficult. Change is always difficult, but a lot of people seem to understand. And I'm really appreciative of that.
I was really touched by the comments I saw online that, obviously it is a huge news and a few people are disappointed, but there's just positivity there and it was really nice to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, thanks to everybody. And thanks to everybody who's supported us. And please keep supporting us in the future because, as I say, we're still going to be doing the podcast, but we are still writing in Linux Voice in Linux Magazine. So if you go to linux-magazine.com, there's a link in there to a shop where you can subscribe to us. Even though it's not our company, it's still our words, and I think that's kind of the most important thing.
Yeah. Just so any subscribers who aren't aware of this yet, your subscription will continue, but you will have or will soon receive a copy of Linux Magazine instead of Linux Voice. And that will obviously run out for the term of your subscription. But you should have had an email about this. If you haven't, shout at us and we'll sort it out. Right, should we move on to more Linux news? Linux is wildly insecure. It turns out there's a privilege escalation bug in the copy-on-write part of the memory management jobby that's been around for 9 years. And it's a race condition that basically allows any user to magically convert themselves into the root user quite quickly and relatively easily once you've managed to figure out how to exploit this. And there is code, or there has been code used in the wild exploiting this. So it's a pretty serious situation because obviously it's a privilege escalation means you have to have an account on your system anyway. But a lot of Linux security is based on user access roles. So for example, if you run a web server, you probably run it as an Apache user or as a WWData user. So that if anyone does manage to find an exploit in your web page or whatever, they can only access that account, which can be heavily restricted, which provides a lot of security, really. But this sort of allows them to bypass this. So if they find any slight flaw in your website that allows them to run a command as the web user, they can just use this to escalate into a root user and then have complete control of your server, just as an example of how it could happen. And this affects almost every version of Linux for the last 10 years or so. And that includes, yeah, web servers, mobile phones, I assume embedded stuff as well. If that even has different users, I don't know. But yeah, this is a huge thing. It's going under the name Dirty Cow because it's based on the copy on write mechanism. Obviously, if you're running any of the major Linux distributions, patches will be available. Make sure you install them if you haven't already.
Interestingly, I say that interestingly, I think it's the first time the Ubuntu kernel was live patched to fix this Dirty Cow issue, so that at least in this instance you didn't have to reboot the kernel if you were using it.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
Yeah. So do you think there are many more of these exploits to be found? I mean, I guess there might be an infinite number. It depends on the rate of the development on the kernel.
I mean, if you look just at the size of the kernel, there's going to be bugs in it. And because it's the kernel, bugs are likely to be exploitable as security issues. So there's definitely stuff in there. I think in general, it's not easy stuff to find. You know, you need to know what you're doing to root out these security bugs that are left, and it's a hard thing to exploit. Yeah, so it's not, I don't think it's necessarily a massive problem, but all software has security issues. Hopefully the kernel has less than most.
I think it's kind of impossible having, you know, watched like the PlayStation 1, 2, 3, 4, Xbox, Xbox 360, not necessarily one, but all of those systems that you know of, the companies involved have spent considerable sums of money locking down systems that are considerably less complex than the Linux kernel, and it's virtually impossible. You know, it may be possible, I suppose, in certain closed small systems that are created in proper kind of black room development, you know, where every single piece of code is audited 1,000 times for flying an airplane, I would hope. But when you're just loading up a web browser, it's nearly always the web browser, it seems.
Yeah, it's there's no silver bullet to software security. Bugs exist. They're going to continue to exist. I mean, we could, you know, some people like to talk about rewriting the kernel or a kernel in a memory safe language, and that will out some, but at the same time, there's no such thing as a language that is immune to security issues, and there probably never will be. There's certainly no known way of creating one yet. It's just something we have to live with, and the best we can ever really hope for is a system where people, you know, honest people find bugs and are looking for bugs, and they're fixed quickly. You know, it's not perfect, but that's the world we live in. And I think the Linux community is actually really good at, you know, both reporting bugs and fixing them and pushing patches out quickly. Yeah,
I think so. I mean, when it's been patched, you know, on the same day, then
yeah.
And it's open. You know where you stand. So everybody should be updating their critical Linux systems, whatever it is that they're running, especially if they're facing the internet.
Every system's critical, Graham.
Even my brew pie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at things like the IoT attack that took down half the internet because of fridges and whatnot, every system really is critical. I think going forward, software security is going to become a much bigger thing because of things like, yeah, these DDoS attacks based on, you know, millions of stuff that probably should never have had a processor in it in the first place. And, you know, you talked about what, you know, everything is always going to have security issues. So updates and sort of a proper security approach is essential to everything. You know, and that's your critical web servers. That's also your webcam, if it's a web-connected webcam.
But did you see that post from Matthew Garrett about his kettle? I mean, he's tested so many IoT devices now that it's maybe not the Linux that we should be worried about. It's these cheap mass-produced devices that are designed to plug into the internet. And don't forget, I guess with IPv6, every one of these devices will have a singular internet address that you can access from outside your router. And
well, you shouldn't be able to as long as your routers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge ongoing problem, and there isn't yet a good solution to it. I mean, he talks about making ISPs responsible for cutting people off who have their stuff infected. Personally, my thought is that you should make ISPs responsible for locking routers down properly to protect devices and to stop them pushing data out of your local network when they shouldn't be pushing data out of your local network. I know my router is just an off-the-shelf router, and that has absolutely no outbound control, but there's no reason for that. It would be relatively easy to add a system where if you connected to a device to your network, you had to explicitly allow it to send data out. And I don't want my kettle sending data out.
Yeah.
I don't want my webcam sending data out. And these could all very easily be locked down. They could be monitoring for suspicious message patterns, for known bugs, and they could lock it down very quickly. But I don't know. Someone has to come up with a target. Someone with authority to make people do stuff has to come up with something. Otherwise, the internet will cease to work fairly soon.
That person could be Philip Hammond.
Oh.
He was at a speech. He delivered the UK's cyber strategy on Monday. At the Microsoft Digital Futures or something, some Microsoft conference anyway, at which he announced £1.9 billion worth of spending on making the internet safe from Russian hackers. I had a look. The glossary contains 28 variations on the word cyber, which I thought was absolutely just wonderful.
Is there a cyber army?
There isn't a cyber army, but if you bear with me very swiftly... Just let me talk among yourselves just a sec.
Politicians, it's always, if you hear the word cyber, it's usually a politician, isn't it?
Cyber
attacks, cyber warfare, cyber terrorists, cyber paedophiles.
It's either a politician or the blog of a 13-year-old in 1998.
Yeah. Hey, I love Neuromancer just as much as everyone else, you know. But
Neuromancer, that's the one I was trying to think of. So we've got, you know, cyber crime marketplace, cyber attack, cyber crime, cyber ecosystem, cyber incident.
What's cyber a cyber invest, ecosystem?
Cyber resilience, cyber security. My favourite is a cyber physical system, defined as defined as systems with integrated computational and physical components. Semicolon. Smart systems.
Does he mean computers?
Well, indeed, a cyber physical system, something that exists in physical space and can perform computations. That's a phone. That's like any modern car.
It's a
any
portal
object.
Between the physical world and the cyber world.
It's It's the Palantir. It's the ring. What does it mean? Quick, here's £1.9 billion. Make it go away.
I think we have a name for your latest batch of cider, though, Ben.
Cyber cider.
Yeah.
I suppose I've made 5 different types, so I need 5 different names.
Different types of cyber cider.
Cyber. Yeah. There's loads of cybers. Cybers.
Yeah, cyber attack.
Yes. Cyber warfare. Cyber ecosystem.
Cyber marketplace. The other thing that really got me, I mean, I've written more words about this, and you can read them in issue 194 of Linux Magazine. So I'm hoping that this is not a spoiler, more of a whetting your appetite thing. But there's only one mention of legacy systems, and no mention at all of ye olde Windows XP that people just haven't replaced yet. And it troubled me at the time, but no wonder, because I didn't realise then that it was a Microsoft event that he delivered this speech.
Yeah. Yeah.
And half the government still runs XP.
Yeah. How do you acknowledge that as a problem and try and get businesses to do things better if you're one of the worst offenders at being lame?
All right, mate. All right. Good boy.
Doesn't seem to bother the government with any of their other policies.
Stop talking Britain down.
Sorry. I'm just fitting into my role as fifth columnist traitor. That can be on my gravestone.
Should we move on to the next item of news?
Andrew
plays with the dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's have some happy news, shall we? Something that Graham can't possibly turn into a rant on Brexit. Or can he? Let's find out. Ubuntu turns 12. So this is 12 years since the first release of Ubuntu, which is 4.10, Warty Warthog. And the announcement, I'll just read the official announcement for the first release, and that is, Ubuntu is a new distro that brings together an extraordinary breadth of Debian with a fast and easy install, regular release every 6 months, a tight selection of excellent packages installed by default, and a commitment to security updates with 18 months of security and technical support for every release, and a bit more punctuation that I forgot to pronounce. I know that we've announced this a few times over the years when Ubuntu has a birthday and other distros do as well, but it just makes me feel old every time.
Yeah.
Because at least when you think, Red Hat turns whatever, Red Hat was a distro and I started using Linux. This Ubuntu's the new upstart distro, the plucky little new guy, and they're 12.
Yeah, they're going to hide. The old school users hate it because it's dumbing Linux down.
But now Ubuntu's old enough to go to high school.
Yeah.
So is that old school? I don't know.
Yeah, it's got to be, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's out of short trousers.
Uh-huh. It can probably buy a gun in several US states.
Also, those 12 years, they lasted about as long as my summer holidays when I was 12.
Yeah, remember when summer used to last all year?
It's amazing.
Yeah, so I think that's, I don't know if it's good news, it's just news, really.
I think it's good news. It still must be the most popular distro, yeah.
Yeah.
It's continuity is good, stability is good. It's great that Ubuntu has matured into something that's. It's sort of the Debian, what it is now to the Linux ecosystem, what Debian was.
Yeah.
In terms of the number of spin-offs that are coming off of it.
That's probably true, actually, the way it's, because there's so many derivatives and forks and whatever you want to call them of Ubuntu that it's now the father to probably half the Linux distros out there, as Debian was back in the day.
And things like I know that Nopix was a live CD before Ubuntu, but Ubuntu really nailed the super easy installation that asks you 5 questions and installs in the background. You know, whenever you install Windows, if you're unlucky enough to have to do that, or even OS X, you know, it's horrendous. You know, and Ubuntu nailed it 12 years ago. That changed Linux.
It really did. It was a different world, Ubuntu, compared to everything else.
Yeah.
You didn't have to know what your keyboard layout was to get any further, and it just made a guess.
IRQs for your sound card. I put in the wrong number. It wasn't 3F8.
I'd forgotten about that, Graham. You're just flooding back horrible memories.
No. IRQs were numbers up to 16, so it was the DMA that was the 3F8.
I'm so glad I've forgotten that.
Yeah, that was horrendous, wasn't it? ISA bus cards that couldn't share an IRQ. And then if you had too many of them, you had to create some horrible hodgepodge.
Yeah. But thankfully, now we don't have to do any of that. Just hit enter a few times and you have a working Linux system.
Yeah, well, apart from Pulse Audio.
I've still never had a problem with Pulse Audio. No, I did actually once have a problem with Pulse Audio, but only because I installed like 5 different audio subsystems at once and tried to run them all.
I think it's just me because I've got so many things plugged in.
Yeah.
But
right, should we move on to our final item of news this fortnight?
Yeah.
And that is the Collabora Online Development Edition 2.0, or Code 2.0 for short, has been released. And this is their online document editor, online office suite, basically, that was released, when was it first released? About a year ago, probably.
Yeah.
And it's obviously got loads of sort of regular enhancements, just making it generally better. But the big new headline feature is a collaborative editing. So you'll may well be familiar with this from other online office suites, where more than one person can edit a document at the same time, and you can see what each other's doing with little sort of captions and coloured cursors as you enter the text and whatnot.
And like Google Docs.
Yeah,
basically like Google Docs.
Open source.
Yeah, it's open source and it integrates with OwnCloud, NextCloud, or Paedio. I've no idea how you pronounce that, but if you use it, you probably know what it is. It works really well. You can it does exactly what it says on the tin, basically. And it's a great piece of open source software that's making it more and more accessible, particularly for sort of companies switching away from proprietary solutions to having in-house hosted systems. Stuff like this is a major advantage. So well done, Collabora. Is it just me, though, that hates the name?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a crap name.
It falls into that
Collabora. Is it Collabora or is it Collabora?
Oh, I actually meant the Code, Collabora Online Development Edition.
Yeah.
Because that's obviously just an attempt to make it spell out code, but Code makes you think it's a programming thing, which it's not at all. And that's almost a slightly scary name to non-technical people, whereas what you want is a super fun and easy document editor.
Yeah.
2.1 Spring beta.
Yes. But
naming aside, well done, Collabora. And everyone else who's contributed.
And whoever it was that sponsored all this development at Collabora, I think because there are a couple of commercial companies that are wanting this themselves, that I think that are paying for the developers through Collabora to implement it.
Yeah, and Collabora do a hosted version as well. So if you just want it to run but don't want it to be Google, you can pay Collabora to do it instead. So that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent. Thanks, Ben.
That was pretty much lightning news, that.
Only 25 minutes.
Right, so it's time for... Hey, this is the first time in a while I can say finds of the fortnight, and it's been a fortnight, I think. I asked the IRC channel. They managed to come out of their collective depression and find a few finds. Z Moylan says that MS is taking on Slack, but I've not seen that.
There was a Slack took out a full page ad in the New York Times, I saw.
Oh, right.
But the picture I saw of it had the text too small to actually read, so I don't know what the advert said.
So does this imply, I mean, I just took a look at Hacker News and it wasn't there, so does this mean that Slack's being bought by Microsoft?
No, I don't think that. I think Microsoft are trying to re-implement Slack's features.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It says, well done for joining the party late. We welcome the competition. Come at us, bro.
Oh, right. Okay, so M1C4HTRON13, they suggest WP Scan. It's a great little tool to scan your WordPress site and all its plugins for vulnerabilities and outdated versions. The WordPress code lifted by Wix. Linux is now 3% of the desktop share. I think I remember reading that as well for the last couple of months. It's stayed above 3%. Somebody suggests this may be the year of the Linux on the desktop again. It was above 2% for 3 months. And then something about Mac users turning to Linux. I saw that as well. Elementary OS did a blog post on after the Apple's recent announcement for its shiny, expensive hardware, lots of apparently places like elementary OS have had tons of hits from disgruntled Mac users looking to put Linux on their Macs. They're the fines from the IRC channel. I seem to remember as well. Did I read that? I think I saw this in the IRC channel. That Admiral Insurance is
yes.
mining people's social networking to ascertain their risk, which I think is the start of obviously a horrendously scary and difficult slope to get off.
Facebook have blocked them now, I believe.
Oh, have so they?
Yeah, they said it's a breach of their privacy rules.
Okay.
Well, that's apparently good. They have a privacy rule.
An official spokesman said, "This is really creepy, even for us. No. We're way weirded out, man. Gnarly."
Facebook's like, "Damn, we should have thought of that. Let's block it. Monetize it." That's the truth. Come on.
I can see this being Facebook insurance now.
Well, it's car insurance is one thing, but it's stuff like health insurance that really worries me.
Yeah, totes.
But does this mean that if I just create a Facebook page and I post about, I don't know, puppies or something, I get cheap car insurance?
Another safe drive. Drove 10,000 miles this year and didn't have a single crash.
Or should it be the other way? It should be like, oh, I drove my car 1 mile for the first time this year. Didn't go above 10 miles an hour, though.
Wasn't the plan to use things like punctuation? How many exclamation marks you use?
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was more subtle than just had a crash today, lol.
It was like profiling, really.
Yeah. Really creepy, really weird stuff.
Yeah.
I find it pretty creepy that a lot of them do the... I find it pretty creepy that a lot of them do the phone tracking thing now.
Yeah.
If you let your phone track where you're driving, you get cheaper insurance.
I find that creepy. But then when it's £1,000 a year for insurance when you're young, I can understand why kids are doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand why they're doing it.
I could get £3 off my phone if I let Tesco Mobile give me carefully targeted ads from our selected partners. Incroyable.
Right, so I have got a couple of fines. One of them is a really cool command line thing called Powerline. And because I'm using the command line more and more, I saw lots of videos by elite hackers doing stuff on the command line. And they all seemed to have this special cool command prompt that didn't look like ASCII text. It was it kind of looked like, I don't know, a more graphical oriented prompt. And this is a tool called Powerline, which started off as basically a small kind of status bar for Vim, but has extracted itself from Vim and become a more modular thing. So you install it. It's a bit tricky to install, actually, but you install it and you can use a plugin system a bit like Tmux so it turns Vim into, you know, it shows you details like the percentage of the document you're through and what kind of mode you're in and highlighting modes and spelling modes. And on the command line, it'll highlight where you are. And if you install the Git plugin, it'll do all that Git stuff. And because it's blocks of color and kind of characters, a special font is used, it really demarks the different sections of your command line and makes it much easier to use. I really like it. My second find is I got an old monitor that was better than another monitor I had in my arcade machine. So I upgraded it last weekend. It's like this huge vertical ancient thing. And because it's vertical, I had to look for another front end because I didn't really, I'd coded my old front end myself. And I found something called a tracked mode. I'd not seen this before, but a tracked mode is when you run an emulator system on something like an arcade machine, you need a very simple user interface to be able to navigate between the games. And this is what they call a front end. And you need to be able to navigate this effectively with a joystick and a couple of buttons. If possible, with some nice pictures and previews of the games you're going to play. And a tracked mode, I think, is named after the beeping that arcade games make when you leave them alone in cinema foyers. you know, to try and attract attention. It's basically one of these layout systems for accessing the emulators, and it's really, really cool. I didn't realize Linux and open source had a tool like this, but the only slight hitch is that there aren't any proper decent themes that come with it, so you have to get stuck in and make your own, but it's really, really powerful, really nice. So it feels like a whole new arcade machine now. I pulled it out and found a load of mouse droppings as well in the corner of the room, which is quite worrying.
Is this I remember when you first got it, you spent quite a while on the OpenGL filters, didn't you?
I did. Actually,
to make the new screen look like a 1980s film.
That's right. Screen. And actually, there were some custom shaders. You're right. So I've had to tweak those to do the same effect. And inadvertently, I didn't realise, but the latest couple of versions of MAME just this year have implemented their own shader system for doing the same distortion, so you don't have to patch the code anymore. So
I guess really my question was, when you've got filters to make it look like an old screen anyway, why have you upgraded it?
Well, this new screen is just bigger. It's as simple as that. My old screen must only have been, I think it was 17 or 19 inches. Yeah. So this is like 24 or 25 or something. So, and I don't play the games any bigger. What I do is I have parts of the arcade box marquee around the edge of the display. Yeah, it's all very sad and middle-aged, but I couldn't afford to play them when I was a kid.
What's your game of the moment? Which one are you getting into?
I mostly only ever play Galaga. It's just so easy and simple, and I just try and beat my high score. I just love it. It's just really good. And it's quick. You get through even if you get into the hundreds of thousands, you can play a game of Galaga in about 5 or 6 minutes.
I remember I got really into Galaga years back, but then one day I was just completely in the zone. I doubled or tripled my high score, and I could never even get close to that again, and it just ruined it for me. I was like, I knew I was never going to beat it.
But it is a game like that. It's a game that you get into a zone, you know, like an exercise zone where you just let everything come flying down around you. And for some reason, sometimes the craft just, it's like a religious experience.
Yeah.
So they were my finds, if anyone else has any to share.
My first find this fortnight has absolutely nothing to do with Linux, but it really shocked me. So I'm going to share it anyway. And that's that your tonsils aren't the sort of dangly bit at the back of your throat that I always thought was your tonsils. Maybe it's just me that thought this. Everyone else probably knew this already, but the tonsils are bits at the side of the back of your throat.
From the orthography of English, which admittedly is inconsistent, a single thing dangling about at the back of your throat would probably not be called your tonsils, because you would guess that they're plural.
Well, fine with your logic and etymology and reasoning. Anyway, I always thought that was my tonsils, but it's not. That's I've got it written down somewhere. Uvula. The way you're staring blankly at me, I assume it was only me that thought that was my tonsils. Yeah,
in the whole world.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I can't. Sorry. I can't. I think I didn't. I suppose I did think that was tonsil. Yeah. I have a lot of confusion because I went when I was like a teenager. I went and had my adenoids out, and I don't even know where they are. And I think they're somewhere at the back of the that kind of nasal system somewhere. And I kind of knew then that it wasn't my tonsils at the front. But I've never. The truth is that I wouldn't be able. What are your tonsils?
You can sort of see them if you look into your mouth with the light. They're just sort of the flaps
fluffy bits
at the back
on the side.
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks, Ben.
That floored me for like 3 days. I couldn't. It just mentally broke my head. I was so sure those were your tonsils. let's move on to some more Linux-related finds. This isn't new, but I only found it recently, and it's Linux Against Humanity. I don't know if you've ever played Cards Against Humanity, which it's basically sort of like a fill-in-the-blanks type game, but with various... basically it's to make yourself sound like a sick and horrible person. So this is a similar sort of thing, but based around Linux. So you have like little blank things that you have to fill in with other things, and it's all Linux based. And it looks like quite a fun little game that you can download and print out. It's created by Brian Lunduke, who's a, I don't know how to describe him, podcaster, writer, shouter about things. And once upon a time game developer, but I don't think he does that anymore. Yeah, that looked like a good fun game, but I'm yet to play around, so I can't conclusively say that. And yeah, my other find is this actually follows on from the last podcast where we were talking about PowerShell and about how it was good for passing, you can use it for passing objects between different commands in the same way you can do text in on the Linux command line. And I sort of was thinking about this because actually this is something I've had issues with when you're trying to work with JSON. Linux tools aren't really that great for you. You know, you can sort of use grep and sed or whatever and pass it between stuff, but it doesn't really work. So I was wondering, you know, I was considering if I should start looking into PowerShell for this sort of thing. But then I came across JQ, which bills itself as sed for JSON, which sort of is what it sort of does that. And it allows you to, yeah, parse a chunk of JSON text and sort of extract the bits you need, poke bits in, twiddle it around and manipulate it how you want, but just within one handy command line tool.
So in being different to sed, it kind of does it give you some context to the results that it provides?
Well, it does it in, it understands the JSON. JSON is JavaScript object notation. It's basically using curly brackets for breaking an ordered bit of information down into text, I guess. So you can have sort of child objects and it can understand that. And you can say, okay, get me the value of this from within that child, or find this thing and look up what its parent is. So it allows you to do much more of, yeah, context processing, really, and understanding the JSON rather than just pulling out individual bits of text.
Without manually saying, if this, if this, if this.
Yeah, exactly. And also things like JSON can be, you know, in one big line without line breaks. You put line breaks in wherever you want, and that can sort of throw off a lot of Linux tools. So yeah, if you're handling JSON, it's a much better option than the standard command line tools. And those are my finds.
Cool, thanks, Ben.
So my find. My find is related to our lead news item, and it is that the computers that in Job Club have OpenOffice installed on them, which is not LibreOffice, mind.
They need a consultant or something.
Not come hurtling into 2011 yet, but still, the good news is that they're not running, they're not spending loads of our money on Windows licenses, so that's great. And that's exactly the sort of place where it should be. You know, the public sector should be putting free software on stuff like that that doesn't really necessarily need to interact with anything, even though obviously standards compliance has come on a lot and LibreOffice is fantastic in that regard. But if all you want to do is write a CV or a letter, it's perfect. And I'm so glad that somebody has had the sense to say, actually, no, we won't waste that money. Instead, we'll get a free solution that works just as well. And I nicked a pen as well.
Yeah.
Is that on the principle that if you take enough pens, they won't be able to afford Windows next time and they'll have to put Linux on their new computers?
So I want one of Pauline's pens, so I could write a list of options before I go and get a job as a fireman, etc. No, seriously, asthma, so no job as a fireman for me.
Right, excellent. Thanks, guys.
It's time for our halfway reminder. Still to come, we don't have any neurons, but we do have Voice of the Masses. It's time for Voice of the Masses. In which we asked, I mean, this is pertinent because I took three laptops to the tip on Sunday because they were all knackered, and I mean actually knackered, not in the, oh, have you tried getting rid of Windows and putting Linux on them? I mean, really, they didn't work anymore. They were physically broken. So, Voice of the Masters, what are the best laptops for running Linux? I'll cut to the chase here. The masses say that a ThinkPad is the best for running Linux because all the developers use them and therefore all the drivers work. Franklin...
All right, mate. All right.
Franklin Demand
says... Begbie agree?
That's, Begbie agrees. The dog agrees. Franklin Demand says... ThinkPads worked for me since 2001. All ThinkPads still working, be it 900 megahertz or 3.2 gigahertz. Several chipsets working from day one. Dar Shagnon, ThinkPads, e.g. the good old X220, but certainly also the very new ones. John Lane doesn't actually say that ThinkPads are that great. B-Fab, ThinkPads, I've been a diehard user for years. I love the sturdiness and the track points. Currently using, I also manage a fleet of around 90 plus ThinkPads, all running either Ubuntu or Lubuntu.
Wow.
Paul says, refurbished ThinkPads for three reasons. Good bang for buck performance price, e.g. an X220 with 8 gig of RAM and a 250 gig SSD costs £350, including delivery. Oh. Wow.
That's cheaper than the SSD drive in my Mac.
That's amazing. I was looking into a Chromebook, but that sounds great. Great keyboards on most models, and lots of developers use them. Stuart says, ex-corporate ThinkPads. Everyone says ThinkPads. Barbara Harris says ThinkPads. Mr. MJB says ThinkPad. Giant Albino Penguin says ThinkPad. ThinkPads for the win.
Wow.
I know Mike has Linux on his MacBook Pro, doesn't he?
I think he does, yeah. I mean, I have it on mine. I use it all the time, every day on mine. I use Arch on there. Mike's, I think, got Lubuntu on his. And, I like the hardware, I like the touchpad, and I really like the screen. But since I upgraded the SSD, it doesn't suspend and resume. And it's always such a pain trying to get Apple hardware to work, and it's probably going to get even more of a pain now. I mean, if we needed the Macs for the work that we were doing, so I couldn't wholeheartedly recommend it. Great battery life as well. I had an XPS 13 for a while, and that was good. But I think it's always so hit and miss with Dell. I mean, that was an Ubuntu XPS 13. And even then, the wireless card in it was the wrong one and didn't work in Linux. So they sort out those problems, but it is difficult.
Yeah, I guess it is sort of... Because it is really important to support manufacturers that put Linux on new computers, because that's the way we get good new computers that run Linux. But Dell have dropped the ball a couple of times with the XPS 13, and I'd love to be able to say more about it, but I've never used one. I've heard good things about the newer models, but...
They've got great screen, and they've got great battery life, and for me, a really good form factor, because for a laptop, I like to be able to move with it. Like, if I'm in a conference, I like to be able to pick it up with one hand and walk from one place to another with it, rather than like a full-on workstation. That's what I've always found ThinkPads to be a bit big for.
I can just come back to an amazing ThinkPad. Barbara M. Harris, a few months ago, I picked up a ThinkPad T420 as a workhorse laptop with an i7 processor on eBay for $250. And she increased the RAM from 8 gig to 16 gig.
Wow.
That's about £245. That's really cheap.
£500.
£600.
Is this in real time?
Yeah. £700.
Welcome to Weimar, Yorkshire.
Three sheep and a shepherd.
Yeah, Callum says, my Dell XPS 13 Dev Edition came with Ubuntu, have since installed Fedora. Not yet had anything, not just work. Doesn't hurt that they look good too. Burgess Meredith says, oh God, do I want a Dell XPS 13 Dev Edition? But he's currently using a little i3 VivoBook and loves it.
I had a Samsung NC10. Do you remember those netbooks? And I loved that. That was just that, you know, that's so small. The battery life was so long. It was just so useful for just typing things.
We got one of those into test, didn't we? And I messed about with it and then put it under the desk and forgot about it for weeks and weeks and turned it back on again. And the battery was still alive and kicking. It was amazing.
Yeah.
More recommendations. More. Give us more, masses. Dale says, in my experience, you can get Linux working on almost all laptops. It may just be a distro you do not like that works. Zubuntu has been my go-to distro because it just seems to work on everything. Also running it on Chromebook with Crouton. Now, no one else has mentioned Chromebooks, which kind of puts me in mind that I should maybe not get one. Have you tried any of those new Chromebooks? Or are they a bit too new?
I've got a Chromebook, and I use it. It's probably the outside of work. It's my main laptop. It's, yeah, if I just need to drop an email or, you know, watch something lying down on the sofa, whatever, it's a laptop I'll pick up and use. And for a while, I had Linux installed on it. But the problem is, because of their sort of, I don't know, whatever you want to call BIOS type thing that's probably not BIOS, when you install something else, you get a little message saying, oh, this isn't signed. Press Control D to continue or something. And it's like a security thing to try and, I don't know, stop some imaginary virus taking over your machine. And it generally works. You just press Control D to boot it up and it works fine. However, when my wife picked it up and opened it up, she was like, oh my God. Ah. And if you hit enter instead of Control D, it wipes everything else.
What?
Yeah. So,
Google.
So yeah, that wipes Linux off it. And to be honest, I haven't put it back on. I could have done it. It's not an especially difficult process. But what I was using it for, Chrome OS, was fine. So I left it at that. And I've got my, my Linux desktop as my main PC.
You're not worried about being spied on?
I'm just aware that I'm being spied on whatever I do.
Fair enough. Right, so to sum up, ThinkPads, that's the answer.
Yeah, it makes me feel like getting a ThinkPad from the next
laptop, me too.
Whenever that is.
Yeah, I really wish I didn't. I mean, I don't think I had any bitcoins on those machines. Anyway, that's all the masses. Get a ThinkPad.
That's great.
This podcast is sponsored by IBM.
They don't make ThinkPads anymore.
Don't they? Oh no! When did they stop making ThinkPads? Was it about 20 years ago?
Yeah, they've been Lenovo for quite a while.
Right, so that's that then.
Excellent. Hopefully we'll stick to our new rigid every fortnight schedule and we'll see you in exactly 2 weeks. If I run, I could get to see the last half of Killing Joke at Fibbers in York. So I'll see you all later.
All right.
Au revoir.
Bye.
Bye.